I'd like to start with some broad motivation. And just that most of us are here because we're interested in the following types of questions. We're interested in, you know, what states have good geometric duals? How do we understand holographic RG and the emergence of the radial direction? And we're just in what is the meaning of area in space-time and the relation to black hole entropy? But we're also here, I think, because we have a particular hope of how these questions might be answered, a particular set of tools we want to use to answer them. And so we want to know, to what extent is this geometry determined by information theoretic and entropic CFD quantities? And what, you know, what information precisely about the state is necessary to fix the geometry? We're interested to know, is there an interpretation in terms of some information theoretic coarse graining scheme for the holographic RG? And we're interested in understanding what is the entropy that is meant to be area actually counting. So what is this coarse graining scheme that gives some meaning of area as entropy? But this conference is called Quantum Information and Quantum Gravity 2. It means there was a quantum gravity 1. And so I think it's useful to look back at where we were at the same time last year, Quantum Information and Quantum Gravity 1, and see what progress we have made and where we're still hopelessly confused. So last year, some of us were there, and they asked us to dedicate some large portion of our time to giving some sort of open questions that we'd like to try to solve in the upcoming year. And so I'd like to go through some of those questions and see to what extent kinematic space has been useful to answer those questions and to what extent we're still lost. So let's pull up some slides from last year and see how well or poorly we've done at this task. I'm going to say, note, this presentation will be a reenactment of last year. It's not history. So past slides may have been edited for continuity and brevity, although I promised you I have not cleaned up our misconceptions and confusions to paint a prettier picture of what we said. So here's a hint from Tensor Networks and the MERA. So last year, we sort of laid out what we thought was the right philosophy for understanding how bulk geometry emerges. And the kind of example, the toy model we wanted to use for this was MERA. And so what Swingle taught us is that one can efficiently, well, Swingle never taught this. Other people here in the audience taught us this fact, that one can efficiently represent certain low energy states by a lattice of unitary operators. And what Swingle told us is that he suggested this has a structure of the vacuum state of the lattice for the vacuum state of the CFD mimics the coarse structure of anti-de Sitter space. And so this seemed to be, in MERA, an answer to the first question I posed of how we see emergent geometry. There's also this fact that lattice points deeper in the bulk, deeper inside this tensor network, encode IR entanglement in the CFT. And so MERA itself also seemed to have an answer to the second question. It told you how bulk geometry, this tensor network, was organizing the length scale of entanglement in the boundary CFT. It's also very interesting that when we cut out some region of this tensor network, we remove a number of unitary operators proportional to the area of the cut. And so the number of possible states that fills in this cut by sort of putting all possible input states along these inner edges of the tensor network is counted by the area if we call the area the number of cuts along this boundary. And so it also seems to include in it an answer to question 3. What is the meaning of the entropy that we call area? So this was a very nice story that we proposed last year. And the real question is, you know, how do we extend this beyond the ground state? What is the general story that MERA seems to be a very nice example of? And so I think what MERA motivated us to do was to rephrase those three questions I posed in my first slide. And so what I want to ask today and what we've been thinking about this past year is, what is the analog of the MERA network for non-vacuum state? So what are the rules for building the right type of tensor network? What boundary data determines this network, and when is this network geometric? The reinterpretation of the second question I posed, I want to say, how do we interpret the holographic RG in terms of some, you know, the nature of this tensor network, its construction, and the skeleton that it has? And what are the entropic meaning of subregions of a tensor network? What is this entropy actually counting in terms of states prepared by tensor networks? And then the final question that I want to add to this list is just one that says, how do we translate between this very discrete tensor network language and some more proper continuum language for talking about conformal field theory? So our starting point for answering these three questions is maybe seems like a slight detour, but it's going to be differential entropy. And we heard a little bit about it earlier, so I just want to give a very schematic, high-level one slide about differential entropy. Differential entropy just says we begin by noting that we can write the integral for the length of some area that is the boundary of this region here, just as sort of in integrating over the tangent vectors. But what we do is we take a non-local transformation of these tangent vectors and turn them into boundary-anchored geodesics. So for every tangent vector I had that was using to compute the area, I just integrated out to the boundary where it has some left boundary point u and some right boundary point v. And so I use these as sort of the new variables in my area integral. These geodesics are sometimes minimal. And what Ru Takanagi tells us is their length is actually the entanglement entropy of the region. So now I can translate once more. I've gone from just some area integral using tangent vectors to some area integral in terms of entanglement entropies. And what's beautiful about differential entropy, which makes this sort of not just a trivial rewriting, is that it takes a miraculously simple form. So you can write this area in terms of just this first derivative of the entanglement entropy with respect to one of its endpoints. So, you know, this is a very nice form, which suggests there's some, you know, important idea here. It's not just some rewriting that was possible. So this is what we were thinking about last year. And the question we posed at the last conference was, is there some relation between this formula and integral geometry? So what is integral geometry? Integral geometry studies measures on geometric spaces that are invariant under actions of symmetry groups. And there's sort of two classical results in integral geometry. The first result has already shown up in ADS-CFT, and it's the Radon transform. So the Radon transform of some function f is just the integral of that function f over a geodesic. So here we're talking just about the, you know, the real plane. So the geodesics are just straight lines. We integrate f over some straight line, and that defines a function on that straight line. But there's another classic result of integral geometry, and that's the Crofton formula. And the Crofton formula has not appeared sort of prior to recently in the ADS-CFT literature. And it just says that if you want to find the area of some curve, what you do is you integrate over this same space of all lines, and you just weight that integral by some intersection number. So, you know, if we're integrating over this line, it hits my curve twice. So this number is 2, and then some appropriate invariant measure. And if we do that, this integral gives you the length of that curve. So this is sort of another interesting way of computing the length of a curve. It looks at first glance different from the way that we were computing areas using differential entropy. You might sort of wonder what is the connection between the two of them. Well, let's try to extend the Crofton formula integral geometry to hyperbolic space. This is something that mathematicians have already done. So if we let gamma be the space of planes in hyperbolic space, then there is another Crofton formula. And if we call the Crofton form here this measure, a volume form, then we might ask, you know, what is the geometry of this dual space, this space of planes in hyperbolic space? And it has a metric that is just Lorentzian de Sitter space. So this is a sort of a very nice geometrization of this dual space. And so we said that this Crofton form for hyperbolic space appears distinct from our Crofton, from the differential entropy. But if we integrate first over one of the coordinates, let's say we integrate over the size, and we do this alpha, I'll say this alpha size integral, what I find is that by doing that one integral, what I'm left with is actually the differential entropy formula. So the differential entropy formula is just some partial integration of the Crofton form. So this seems very suggestive that there maybe is some deep connection between differential entropy and some kinematic space, some integral geometry construct. And so that's what I'd like to outline for you the construction of. So I sort of started with some small example and built up. This is probably how it was done, but let's sort of go in the opposite direction and pretend we knew what we were doing from the beginning. And so we're going to start very high level. And so let's say we'd like to describe geometry in terms of some information theoretic quantities. You know, these quantities we know are not local observables in the geometry, but they're integrated quantities. If we want to calculate the entanglement entropy, we have to integrate something in the geometry. And so it would be natural to describe a geometry then indirectly by using some auxiliary space that is an integral transform of our local real geometric space. In the context of two-dimensional bulk spatial geometry, we want a dual space whose points correspond to geodesics. And we're going to call this space the associated kinematic space for our geometry. So what we're envisaging is that we have some real geometry We have some kinematic geometry, that's the integral transform, and we have over here kind of our boundary CFT. And the hope is that because things that were integrated here are local here, that this kinematic space should be a good auxiliary space that translates between the two languages, the language of information theory in the CFT, and gravity and local real geometry in the bulk. So the question that we need to answer if something like this is going to be possible is that, is there a measure on the space of geodesics so the Crofton formula works more generally? So what existed in the mathematical literature was just a formula that worked for the hyperbolic disk and a few other very nice symmetric spaces. If we really want to extend this program to be, you know, good for talking about gravity, we want to be able to do it for arbitrary spacetimes. So yes, there is a natural Crofton form that reproduces the length of any curve in any geometry whose tangent space is covered by boundary anchored geodesics. This Crofton form is given by a very simple form. It's just the second derivative of the length of that boundary anchored geodesic. So it's the second derivative of what I'm going to call the entropy, and I'm not going to worry too much at this point whether I'm talking about an entropy or just a geodesic for some that's anchored on the boundary. So again, it'll be natural to interpret the density as the volume form on our kinematic space. And so, you know, if this were the hyperbolic disk, then this volume form here we get is just, again, this Lorentzian de Sitter geometry. In general, if we have some perturbed spatial slice, then we're going to see that it is some perturbed de Sitter geometry that we get out. I told you that this space is Lorentzian. This means that it has a causal structure. And you might ask, you know, where did that come from? Who ordered that? We started with some real space, we did an integral transform, and we ended up with some Lorentzian space. So I better be able to tell you the meaning of that causal structure. So let's examine two points in the space that are time-like separated. So here I take some point here and some point here, they're time-like separated, and I draw their geodesics in this real geometry. And so what we see actually is that the time-like separation means that the intervals are contained in one another. So this gives sort of a nice interpretation to being, you know, time-like accessible, to be causally related. It means you can get from one interval to the other interval by tracing out. It really is sort of accessible in terms of the density matrices. You might expect if something is light-like separated, it just means it's on the boundary of being contained, so they share an endpoint. And when they're space-like separated, it means that the two intervals are not, one is not contained in the other. So you can see here that you know, this interval sort of extends beyond the edge here. And so, you know, this really says then that things that are space-like separated, they're acausal, really means that if you had the density matrix for one, there's no way you could trace out or do some operation to get the density matrix for the other. You're really, it is inaccessible to you. Pardon? Yeah. They could be disjoint. So slightly. So what if they don't actually overlap, it's still inaccessible. It's space-like from this point. But what it does mean is if you took that other geodesic and you inverted its orientation, that it would be contained in its in the other orientation interval. So we should always remember that we're talking, and I actually didn't tell you this, that we're talking about geodesics with orientation. So if I have this geodesic, which is spanning this boundary region, I have that same geodesic, but I consider it spanning the other sort of complementary boundary region. And so that is So there's some other point up here, which is its opposite orientation, which they would be time-like separated.
Whether the geodesics actually cross or not. I think more complicated spacetimes, they could have started within each other and then crossed.
True, yes.
So that would still be, you know, time-like related and sort of treated the same way as the...
Yeah, and so the causal structure is really about the containment of the boundary intervals. It's some partial ordering on boundary intervals. It doesn't really tell us anything about what those geodesics are doing in the bulk.
I mean, we could do this whole story without even having a holographic dual.
That's right.
If we had a function S of UV, everything you're saying we could do, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, so it's really, you can always do this for an arbitrary CFT state. What's going to be nice is that there is some very simple structure to this kinematic space when you have a holographic dual. So something I'll talk about later is, well, I think, as Tom has emphasized as well, is that you could take some CST that you know doesn't have a good bulk dual, but you can still create some sort of auxiliary bulk, which is describing its entanglement entropy for single intervals. You know, what's very special about having a bulk dual, what's very special about holographic theories is that, you know, if you know the entanglement entropy for a single interval, you know the entanglement entropy for all the intervals. And so if you, what you could try to do is build a kinematic space that describes, you know, single intervals and their entropies, but you could build another one that describes, you know, two disjoint intervals, three disjoint intervals, four disjoint intervals, and all of these would be incoherent for some arbitrary boundary state. There'd be no relation between any spatial structure in one and the other. But it's, you know, this beautiful fact about holographic duality that says that, you know, all of these sort of many, many kinematic spaces are going to coalesce into, I could describe in sort of one kinematic space. I only need to know about the single interval geodesics to describe all of that data.
You're assuming sometimes spatial homogeneity.
Pardon?
I mean, you're assuming spatial homogeneity. Otherwise, it would not be true that if you knew
single
interval for some interval, you would know it for some
other. No, somewhere else. No, not, I'm not saying one interval. I'm saying if I give you the space of all single interval, so I give you all of a single interval, I give you the data of my kinematic space, which does not assume any spatial homogeneity. But I can use that to fix 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, up to, you know, as many intervals as you like. But that is a bit of a digression, and I was going to talk about that later, so let's keep going. We might ask what the length computations look like in this kinematic space. So what I want to do is compute the length, say, of this very simple curve, and so what I need to do is integrate in this kinematic space over all the geodesics that intersect it. So I find, you know, for some certain angular size, I'm going to call this angular size alpha up here, just the half interval size of this. I'm going to just label this bottom with the coordinate theta being its center. So, you know, up to some alpha, they intersect, and then I keep looking at the intersecting geodesics of larger half angle, and it goes up. You know, all of these ones are going to intersect up to some height up here, where I'm now got to the opposite orientation at the far side. And so I just integrate over this region of kinematic space, and that computes the area of this curve. So that's very simple, maybe not very surprising or hard to see. Well, it may be a little not so intuitive, and I want to tell you about just because I'm going to make a point about it later on in my talk, is that if you try to compute the area of some curve that's not convex, that its description in terms of some integral and kinematic space looks a little different. So it looks like this. So these light blue, this is just a cartoon. That's not, you know, I did not use Mathematica to make these curves. These light blue regions are regions that we integrate over with intersection number 2. So they're geodesics that pass through this curve, they hit it once, and they exit and hit it one more time. But there's these regions that I integrate with intersection number 4. These correspond to geodesics that enter and leave and enter and leave again. And that's sort of the definition of this curve not being convex, that curves can enter and leave more than once. And so they give these little cuspy regions. And they're going to be important for a point I want to make later. So I just want to illustrate what those look like. Any questions right now about this sort of purely geometric picture? I kind of went through it fairly quickly.
The fact that you see the space and have curvature comes from somewhere in the, from the entropy and somehow some property of
the. That's right. So the volume form in this space is related to, I will tell you about that in a moment. Actually, I have one more slide, actually. So let's go through that. So the volume form is chosen to be geometrically useful, right? I chose that volume form because it was the right volume form to reproduce the areas of curves. But it also has a very simple information theoretic interpretation. So what I want to do is look at some region of my geometry where I'm going to take some boundary region A, B, and C, and then just draw these light rays up from these regions. And I'm going to look at this region here in the intersection. And what I find is if I integrate my volume form over this area, it computes just the conditional mutual information. That's maybe not so surprising if you think this was just a second derivative. I integrate over this region. It's just the function at its endpoint. So, you know, it's S of AB plus S of BC minus SB minus SABC. So you can kind of see how that naturally falls out. But what it means is that this volume form also localizes information theoretic quantities in this space. So we already see coming out of this, what I said at the beginning, that if we do some, if we have some integral transform space, things that were non-local in the real geometry are now locally computable in this geometry. So this is, I think, is a very nice consequence of talking about this space already.
I'm a little lost in the picture. So A and B are intervals in the real space or intervals in the kinematic space?
So yeah. Well, if you think about it, so I indicated A and B and C as spaces on the boundary of kinematic space, but at the boundary of kinematic space are just the infinitesimally small intervals. And so there is a precise identification between a boundary region of kinematic space and a boundary region of real space. So in the limit that some interval becomes infinitesimally small, it's picking out a unique point. So this is the boundary region A, B, and C in the CFT. Other questions? So now I'd like to just return to Mera for a moment. So let's talk a little bit more about Mera and holography. So we know that the Mera network has an additional spatial dimension to the boundary state. And we know that it's related to the length scale of entanglement coarse graining. We've also been told that it's very natural to view the Mera as related to holographic geometry. And this can be made more precise. So what we want to do is associate some fixed distance in the geometry described by this, the discrete geometry described by this lattice. And the distance is, you would give a fixed distance to every line that you cut in this lattice. So it's some sort of line crossing metric. And the corresponding metric you get out of that line crossing is that of a sort of a discrete version of a spatial slice of ADS2 or of hyperbolic space. But what's really nice, I think, is that Mera viewed as a discretized ADS2 geometry also realizes the Ru Takanagi procedure for calculating entanglement entropies. So if we consider some region L in our state at the bottom, and we consider the minimal cut through this network that is homologous to that boundary region, and then we look at the number of lines that are cut, then we find that the number of lines cut is just proportional to the log of the number of sites in this boundary region. And so if we look at the density matrix that prepares this part of the state, it's determined by some IR density matrix that lives along here. And the dimension of the IR Hilbert space will give some upper bound on the possible entanglement entropy of this state here. And so we find that the entanglement entropy of our interval has some upper bound that is proportional to the log of the number of sites. And this is a scaling that is realized in the ground state. And so we see that to some level that Mera is correctly reproducing the Ru Takanagi behavior that we expect to see in the bulk geometry. Those are two nice facts, but there's also things that I think are not so nice about this picture, things that don't work quite as well. The first thing is, in signing the metric to the Mera network, we just assumed a Euclidean signature. But this was not something that I derived there. I just said, let's put a Euclidean metric for crossing lines. But I think that the network can have a causal structure associated to it that's really suggestive more of a Lorentzian signature. So how do we see that? Well, what I can do is look at a region called the causal cone. The causal in there, I think, was not originally meant to suggest, causal in the Lorentzian sense. But I think we should actually, take that fortuitous naming choice very seriously. The causal cone is just all of the sites in the network that affect some region. So I can put some line out here. And, if I were calculating just the density matrix for these sites here, I could trace over any, I can trace over any of these tensors in this network that are not in this causal cone. So this, I can sort of give me some outward going light cone. But I also have some inward going light cone. I'm going to call this the exclusive causal cone. These are the sites in the network that only affect this region. So if I were to change some tensor in the network here, it would have no effect on the state anywhere else. And so I can say that the exclusive causal cone gives me some sort of inward going light rays. And so at any point, I can find this exclusive causal cone and this causal cone. And they define a causal structure that gives me light rays across this entire network. So I think this should be inspiring for us. But there's another incongruity with the standard picture, and that's that a particular node in the network corresponds to some unitary transformation that affects a region of a certain size in the state, but I don't think it can be localized, but that can't be localized as a unitary in any smaller interval. So what do I mean? Let's look at this site here in blue. This site in blue has some effect on the network on this boundary region here. But if I looked at either of these other boundary regions here or this overlapping one here, this node can have effects on the state here that cannot be localized by modifying the tensors just here or just here. So it's something that I want to associate to this entire interval and no smaller subinterval. in the typical picture, we would associate this tensor in the network to some region of space here. But you know, this region of space here is not distinguished by anything except for the cutoff. There's an equal bubble here, and there's one here, and there's some little region here and here, and they're all sort of identical. They're all just related to each other by symmetry. Well, this one, you know, if I change the cutoff here, I make my tensor network longer. It doesn't actually change the region it's affecting, and so really, you should maybe be associating it to some diffuse region that is sort of tracing over the entire Ryu Takanagi surface, which maybe suggests that it's more associated to the geodesic itself as opposed to just some particular region of space-time near the tip of that geodesic. So any questions about those two sort of incongruities with the picture? Yeah.
So, when you're supposed to allow the effect of a local, what you might call a local bulk operator to be extending all the way to the boundary?
Yeah, changing this operator affects the state on the boundary in this entire region. So I do not wish to call this a local bulk operator in any sense.
Okay, but you might want to think of it as bulk operators localized on some ADS scale, but you don't want to.
Well, I don't want to do that. I want to say that this is really associated to this interval. I don't want to say that changing this thing is just about small deformations in some little bubble at the end of that Ryu Takanagi surface. And I don't think that that picture emerges very naturally from what this actually does to the CFT state.
Back in your slides when you introduced the integral geometry,
yeah.
You define manifold in terms of sums of geodesics.
Yeah.
Is that all geodesics or just massive ones or light-like ones or what?
So we're just talking here about the spatial geometry. Maybe I did not emphasize this enough. So I'm really just talking about reconstructing some spatial slice. And so it's sort of implicit in what I'm doing that I'm going to assume that that all the RT surfaces lie on this slice, so we need to be in an appropriate scenario for that to be true. And the more covariant, more generalized picture is something that I can't tell you anything precise about right now, although it is certainly an aspiration.
Now, if I think of a local operator in the bulk, then that corresponds to some geodesic in the mirror network. So what does that mean? Expect? Can you write down a proposal for a local bulk operator?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about local bulk operators, but I'm going to say that towards the end of my talk. So let's leave that for now. So I haven't even really told you how we go from this picture to anything that looks like the local bulk. So I'd like to extract some lessons from this little story we told about Mera. So the picture from Mera is not perfect, but I'd like to translate these workings into some general principles for constructing my tensor networks that build sort of more general geometries, arbitrary geometries. And so I want to ask, you know, what is Mera almost doing that's useful? So Mera is not precisely what I want. I want something that's inspired by Mera. And so I want to look at this picture and say, what would my tensor network do that was similar to Mera? And so I think this is sort of the key statement in that Mera only realizes the Ryu Takanagi procedure insofar as the links cut are assumed to be uncorrelated, so that distances and cuts are both additive and locally measurable. What I mean, we do not want this scenario where, you know, I'm measuring some distance, so I take a whole bunch of cuts here, I look at this little link here, and it carries some, you know, and it gives some contribution to the entanglement entropy of this region, so I assign some weight to that cut. But if I sort of went and I took a larger interval, I may find that I found the purification of those degrees of freedom. And so that weight I assigned is no longer true. Now it contributes some smaller length scale. And so this is a problem, right? So there's no really good metric distance I can assign to that cut because it changes based on my choice of completion. And so it's this fact, this assumption that the links cut are uncorrelated with each other, and so we have some sort of local notion of distance that comes out, is really the heart of whether or not a tensor network like Mera describes geometry. So this is, I really think, is the key thing that we should be thinking about. And so it's equivalent to saying that the Ryu Takanagi surface and the tensor network encodes a compressed state of the interval where we've removed all of the mutual information between the edges of the network. So what I want to argue is that this should be elevated to a principle, that we shouldn't just take this as a nice fact. We should really, you know, take this as our starting point. And so my first principle of tensor networks for gravitational states is this fact, that the tensor network should encode the compressed state along the root Takanagi surface. Now, I want to give another sort of sub-principle. And so if the boundary regions are uncorrelated, what we find is that information and correlations in the network are now determined by local properties. So to see this, let's look at a bunch of different regions. So first, we're going to take the region AB and look at its cut here, its root Takanagi surface. And now we can do the same for BC and look at its minimal cut here. We can look at the minimal cut for ABC. We can look at the minimal cut for B. And now we can form this alternating sum where we take AB plus BC minus ABC minus B. And because I assume that these cuts are locally measurable, it doesn't matter which surface they appeared on. I can just add or subtract the entropies. So I get a positive contribution here, a positive contribution here, a positive contribution here, a positive contribution here, and a negative here, and a negative here. And all of these others just cancel out because it didn't matter which surface they lied on. And so what I find is that this sum is computed just by the cuts that bound this little region, and that I now know that this conditional mutual information of these three regions, A, B, C, is now locally measurable by just looking at the sites in the network in this little region. So this is going to be my second principle for constructing tensor networks. I'm going to say that the conditional mutual information is encoded locally. Now, I put a little asterisk that follows from the above assumption, but I really want to sort of elevate it to a principle because we're going to keep it in mind as we sort of set out in our goal. So let's move on to the basics of building tensor networks.
So but this is a property of that you desire for the tensor network, but it's not a property of the bulk, right?
Pardon?
It's not a property of...
No, so we cannot measure the conditional mutual information locally in the bulk.
Right. So now we're starting to diverge the bulk from the tensor network.
That's right. So, okay. And this next
slide. The mirror was supposed to be the bulk, but you're dropping that.
Yeah. So this next slide, I'm going to draw two pictures together. The pictures are colored and drawn to be very suggestive of each other. So what we want to notice is that this little marked region in my Mara tensor network and this little marked region in my kinematic space look very similar to each other. They're similar region. There's a similar region of this network and a similar sort of spatial region of this space, and they both are computing the same information theoretic quantity. And so I'd like to say it's just a small leap now to suggest that the Mara network is actually describing not the hyperbolic geometry, but its dual de Sitter space. These things that I was calling these minimal cuts, they were calling them root Takanagi surfaces. I think we should actually relabel them, and they should be understood as these causal domains of dependence, right? They should be these causal cones, and that the tensor nodes that I have here aren't describing a point in the discretized hyperbolic space, but are really points in some discretized Lorentzian de Sitter space, and they're associated now to some particular geodesic or boundary interval. Yes?
So you had called the purple regions sort of little, in the top picture, that's requires sort of B to be larger than much less, and C to be small and B to be large. In the bottom one, your sort of sketch was the other way, but to require the
I drew these pictures. This is the conditional mutual information here, regardless of the size of these intervals.
Yeah, but the size of the purple region, of course, depends on the size of.
That's right. That's absolutely correct.
So. Have that somehow, but do you want that to be somehow small in some measure on that plot, or was there a meaning to this little
I can do this for little regions, and now I'm just calculating like the infinitesimal volume form. I can integrate the volume form and get it larger, so that both are
right. So,
are
so
true
the
and valid.
One required for that to be the case required A and C to be small.
No, this is just a fact. The volume
be infinitesimal.
The volume form is, if you recall, and so I can integrate this over regions of arbitrary size. So this can be enormous.
That's right. But dV
And this integrated here is always the conditional mutual information of A and C conditioned on B.
I understand, but to get that quantity to be small, it has to be proportional to, you know, dV times du and those things are supposed to be.
That's right.
So what was the counterpart in the bottom picture?
How do I know that this is a small region?
Yeah.
I'll explain this a little bit more in a moment, but this volume corresponds to the number of isometries in this region. And so the number of isometries in the network is going to give me this volume measure on this network. And so when that is small, it means there's very few isometries inserted in this region.
Right. So I would have thought that still would require sort of A and C to be smaller.
It will, yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. So when there's, you know, if A and C are very large, you're going to there's going to be large amounts of isometries, and this can be related to the large mutual information larger mutual information shared between those intervals.
So I sort of understand something here that RT surfaces on the hyperbolic plane are curves, and they can be mapped to boundary causal domains in the two-dimensional space. But it's not obvious to me that this extends anywhere higher. It goes on the higher dimensions.
Yeah, higher dimensions are very confusing. So there are many kinematic spaces that we can draw, and they have the same sort of partial ordering about the inclusion of boundary regions. But there's many issues about higher dimensions, so maybe I'll talk about them a little more at the end if I get there. But let's just say for, you know, probably the rest of my talk, our ambition is only going to be able to understand two-dimensional geometry, and let's not stress out about what extends and what doesn't, because this is confusing enough. Okay, so I'd like to say that, you know, this new language, this new identification neatly resolves all of our lingering unhappiness with the standard model of Mera's hyperbolic space. So every problem I told you exists no longer exists. The problems I didn't tell you exist, I didn't tell you exist. So, but we didn't just find a kinematic space for the ADS vacuum. So that picture I drew for you is Mera and the vacuum. So using our principled approach to understand what Mera is doing, what my Mera-like tensor networks are doing, and our knowledge of kinematic geometry, can we find efficient tensor networks for more general states? So in hindsight, let's modify our principles. Here they are, the principles for tensor networks for general states. First principle is the tensor network should encode the compressed state along the boundary of the domain of dependence of a boundary interval. And the purpose of this domain of dependence is then really to sort of extract all the mutual information that is shared by degrees of freedom in that interval, and that the conditional mutual information is encoded locally by the volume of this, by the volume of kinematic space. So let's see how far we can go with just these ideas.
Just to clarify, your domain of dependence was in kinematic space or in physical space?
In kinematic space. This is the
boundary. Domain of dependence was boundary of the
region. No. I mean, you can make an identification between the two of them, but they definitely do not have, yeah.
Sorry, why would they be related? I could put my feet.
I'm saying the causal structure of the actual causal structure of the CFT is the same as the causal structure of kinematic space.
So that's kind of a coincidence, right?
But how do you
pardon?
That's just because in two dimensions, it's really only one causal structure.
They have the same partial ordering. It's just the partial ordering. Well, I mean, the partial ordering of intervals is the partial ordering that it gives you the causal structure of a space, right? So
the compressed state is the same as the reduced state.
Pardon?
The compressed state is the same as the reduced state in the interval.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
But you've admitted that you're not talking about anything but a time stack. How do you know what the causal structure of the boundary state is?
I mean, yes, I'm not using it in anything I'm doing. I'm just saying it would be the same, that if, you know, if an interval is contained in an interval on the boundary, and I would draw its causal rays, that I can sort of map my kinematic space onto some evolution in the boundary, if I chose to. But I mean, what I'm not saying is that the boundary Hamiltonian evolution is anything related to, you know, any evolution that I get in my kinematic space. I'm just saying that, you know, I could draw the pictures on top of each other. Pardon?
I could just perversely choose a boundary space time.
He's assuming 1 plus 1
flat.
I like size points.
In space time.
Let me just happily like size points on the boundary space.
So then it wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, we can do something more perverse. I'm just saying, in this limited case that I'm talking about there on top of it. But it's really, maybe this is a distraction. So, I mean, the causal structure that I'm talking about is just the partial ordering of intervals. So the requirement that our network performs compression along the future boundary of some region is actually very powerful. So what it does is it limits where correlations can be created in my network. So if I imagined I wanted to create some correlation between the regions A and C at the boundary in my state, and I tried to put them in my network, just some arbitrary place somewhere up here, well, those correlations have to filter down into A and C, and so they would necessarily create correlations along this surface. And so what it means is that I'm not allowed to insert correlations in my network that are measurable in A and C up here. In a similar way, I can't insert those correlations here. And so I'm actually limited. All the correlations between A and C must arise in the network right here. So they must arise in that top diamond. And so what I can say is that information in my tensor network sort of flows along the light rays, that the causal structure is really sort of indicative of information flow in this tensor network. And so let's consider the conditional mutual information of this top region, the conditional mutual information of the regions A and C conditioned on B. So if all the boundaries are uncorrelated, each line in the network gives an additive contribution, as we said before. And as I said before, the conditional mutual information is then just the difference in the number of lines here on the bottom of this region and the number of lines on the top of this region, like it was for Mera. But we know that the difference in number of lines crossing the bottom and the top, it's just the number of lines inserted into the network at this region. And so what we're saying is that the volume integral, the conditional mutual information, is really measuring the insertion of lines into this network. So we can write this as just a measure of the density of correlated pairs that are inserted into the network. So for some arbitrary choice of entanglement entropies, S of UV, we can use the volume form to add lines to the network that prepares the state with exactly these entropies. So my volume form tells me that I'm going to insert an isometer here that generates some entangled pair in here and here and there. And there we go. So now I've actually generated all of the entanglement entropies that you gave me correctly. You know, if you gave me S of UV, I'm going to build my network and it's going to generate it. Fantastic. There we go. There's my tensor network. Looks like we've succeeded. Is this really our desired state? Well, the answer is, of course, no. Although we have, say, all the right entanglement entropies and we have lots of, say, long-range correlation, the long-range correlation is not at all what you expect in a conformal field theory or in a gravitational state. And we have long-range correlation shared between an ultraviolet degree of freedom over there and some ultraviolet degree of freedom over here. And we'll...
It depends on the enclosed interfinders.
Ah, yeah, very good. So I built you some network that reproduced all of the entropies that you gave me. And we were curious, you know, have we built the right state? And the answer is, of course, no. We're missing something important about this network. We can't just insert lines that pass through each other freely.
Well, you meant that's what you were doing.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought by definition of the kinematic space, the conditional mutual information was the area of that diamond.
It's the volume of that diamond.
Volume.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, I said that volume of that diamond tells me in that region, so I've drawn my... here's my boundary state. I drew as some little background all of the causal rays, and now I need to know in this region, you know, the volume tells me how many of these entangled pairs to insert.
So wouldn't you insert one per? I mean, there should be some uniform.
Well, you know, this background is drawn. This background is drawn uniformly in terms of like the causal structure. But I haven't drawn the conformal factor here.
Okay.
What we're really doing is now I'm putting. In all of these nodes that are representing the volume. And so, you know, although this looks like a large area, this actually has zero volume. There's no insertions of correlations here.
So you're just telling us what SUV is.
That's right. I'm building a network that prepares every single interval entanglement entropy correctly. And this is not a very interesting tensor network. It has very perverse behavior where it entangles, you know, UV degrees of freedom far away from each other. This is meant to be a little bit of a straw man for building a better tensor network.
The reason that this information is propagated sort of just along the what would be this null lines rather than the time-like direction.
Yeah.
Was to keep the consistency between the different intervals independent of which curve they lie on. Why was it propagating just as well? I missed that point.
Here is Now here are two regions. Let's just assume that we have two regions, A and C, and they share, let's just say that literally they have this, they share some EPR pair. And so, you know, where do I put that in my tensor network? If I was building an arbitrary tensor network that had no principle, you know, I could create a node here and I could have it kind of filter out through the network into A and C.
You know? There, but I don't understand why it can't be above.
Well, if it was here, then and it did this. Just imagine I had this tensor network, right? Now I looked at the state of the tensor network along the future domain of dependence of ABC, and what I would find is that there's correlations along the state on this domain of dependence. But that violates my rule. I told you that this is the compressed state of ABC, and therefore there can be no correlations between any of the lines here. So I can't put anything up here and then have it filter in. These correlations are measurable here. And so the only place my network allows me to put them is here. And so my compression principle tells you exactly where to insert information. So it's sort of a more restrictive way of building a tensor network. Good.
There's some nice interpretation for the entropy of two intervals from the kinematic space perspective.
Yes, so I probably... Oh, Jesus. Oh, dear. Yeah, that's not going to happen, but yes. So this story I'm going to tell you right now about the role of disentanglers, I can actually use the disentanglers in my network to get the entanglement entropy for every set of two intervals correctly in my tensor network. So I can tell you how to arrange the disentanglers such that you get exactly the Hawking page phase transition where you see that you see the flip between these two cuts that give you the entanglement entropy.
But that's only true for large central charge.
Pardon?
I mean, this is a statement about the CFP, but what you're saying is only true for large central charge.
So I can build states that have this property, and you do not require a large central charge to have this property. So you can build tensor networks that have this behavior more generally. I mean, we saw this earlier as well when we were looking at Fernando's tensor network. As well, that they have this property as well, and there was no large central charge there that made that possible. So while this is a fact about large central charge, we can engineer states that have a very similar behavior, where the entanglement entropy of two intervals is always given by the minimum of the sum of the entanglement entropy of, you know, the two or their complement. So, I think, you know, large central charge comes into this story, but I think it comes into the story much more in the form of, you know, sub-ADS locality. And not so much in this transition between RT surfaces. Good. So the state that I made here was far from generic. There's long-range entanglement, but it's still localized. It's not at all like a good CFT state or good geometric state. And so I need to use the disentanglers in order to correct this problem. So if we read the network from the top down, what's really clear is that the disentanglers are really acting as entanglers. What the role of these disentanglers do is distribute the information over the light cone. So by fixing these disentanglers, I correct this problem. I make all of these sort of entanglement generically be at the same scale that it was created. And so what I want to say is that in order to understand sort of how I go about characterizing these disentanglers, what I note is that this non-local mixing we've been describing is precisely what's measured by the tripartite information. So I3 of ABC is really measuring the difference between, you know, the mutual information between, say, A and C and B and C alone as compared to the mutual information that they have in their joint system. So this is really measuring, if I give some correlation to the system AB with C, how well I've distributed amongst the joint system of A and B. So negativity of the tripartite information, so that it's well distributed, is actually a necessary condition for our methods of building a tensor network, which is something that is unlike Mara proper. Mara proper does not have this restriction. Our networks do. They're more restrictive. We previously had this volume form, du dv of s. So what I want to tell you is that I can also define some other volume form, which is like du dv of I3 in some moral sense. There's actually sort of a whole collection of these volume forms that I can define. They're really measures now of the disentanglers of the tripartite information. And for geometric states with the correct Ruta-Kanagi phase transition, we have a very nice sort of coincidence of these structures, that these two volume forms are the same. So this is good, right? Kinematic space, I only have one kinematic space, and it fixed for me sort of all the single interval entropies. And now you might have asked, you know, I need to know about I3 to fix the two interval entanglement entropies. But we find that when we look at this form, in a geometric state at least, that these are really the same geometric data. And so I don't need anything else. If I wanted to build an arbitrary state that had negative tripartite information, I would use both of these, and they would sort of be sort of separate, incoherent kinematic spaces. So, but I should just say that the equality of these two, this geometric property of my tensor network, is really the condition that every disentangler is maximally mixing. So the condition that my geometric network, my network is geometric, is very similar to the condition that we saw earlier in these other tensor networks, that they all be sort of perfect tensors. This is sort of very much the same idea.
Sorry, I have two arguments. What are A, B, and C?
Yeah, so I put an S here, and I suppressed information here, and because it would be like five, it would be several slides and a lot of pictures to tell you exactly what I mean there. So there's many forms you can have that depend on this sort of third choice of interval. And it's in geometric states that no matter how you choose that, they're all identical, right? So it's the reduction of this large amount of information into a very small amount of information. So I was being very sort of high level and vague, maybe dishonest, to get through this more quickly. So just to summarize what I said, which is maybe, I'm going to use, this is 52 minutes, so I think we're doing okay. I'm going to use these 8 minutes, and people can bother me in the break with questions. So just to summarize what I've told you so far, we constructed a dual kinematic space. These points are boundary-anchored geodesics. We demonstrated that kinematic space is the natural setting of formulating differential entropy in two dimensions. We showed that geometric structures in kinematic space encode simple information theoretic quantities in a CFT state. And we gave an explicit procedure to use these information theoretic quantities to construct, you know, some iterative compression network for a CFT state. And so consequently, what we found is that the geometry of our tensor network is appropriately interpreted is precisely given by kinematic space. And so we've really answered some of the questions that I set forth. What I'd like to do, though, with the last half of my time, I haven't done that one yet. That's my old summary slide, and I moved some stuff later. So ignore that. So the last half of my time, which now will not be shown to you, is just some implications, work in progress, and open questions. So I knew we weren't going to get to all of it, but I'd like to give you at least some of it. And if you're interested, we can talk more after. So to go back to this original thing, I said we were going to go back and see how well we answered all of our questions from last year. So one question we had last year was, you know, we have this differential entropy. What on earth is it counting? So does our new interpretation of kinematic space of differential entropy in kinematic space help answer this question? So differential entropy was only a partial answer to the question, and there were some confusions. So if we talk about the differential entropy for this region, and so it's this integral over the variation of these boundary regions of size R, it was thought somehow that we should assign entropy to the collection of marginal density matrices. We take the density matrix for each of these little regions, and now we think about it very hard. There's missing information. We don't have the complete state. Let's try to assign some, you know, the number of consistent states with all of these marginal density matrices, perhaps. But Brian Swingle and Kim showed us that there's a problem with this procedure. So they said, let's assume the ground state is unique. This is reasonable. Let's take the collection of DART marginal density matrices for every point in the boundary, and then note that this is sufficient to calculate the expectation value of a local Hamiltonian. So if we take the ground state, we take all these marginals, we calculate the expectation value of a Hamiltonian, we can find that, you know, that if the energy is zero, there's really a unique state that's consistent with our set of marginal density matrices. So it's impossible to fill in the hole in the space-time without propagating energy out to the boundary. You know, there's really no uncertainty about the state given a collection of marginals. And so, you know, this is sort of expressed in this understanding of differential entropy. It's kind of a problem with many definitions of residual entropy that would allow you, say, to calculate the local Hamiltonian using your limited set of boundary data. So to see where we went wrong, it's helpful to return to our kinematic space tensor network picture. What we find is that cutting a hole in the interior of the tensor network does not uniquely determine this collection of marginal density matrices. So the density matrix depends on the complete sort of causal cone of that boundary region. and the exterior region cuts the causal cone at its shorter width. So when we remove this region, there's actually lines that are coming across this edge, right? And the state that lives on those lines affects all of these density matrices. And so the information encoded in the exterior of the tensor network is not marginal density matrices. It's really some descending superoperator, I think is the right language to call it. Gifford can correct me if that's not the, what we might want to call it. He doesn't look happy, so we'll just let's keep going. We have this IR state that lives here, and we have this tensor network, and it propagates that IR state out to the UV, right? It adds the appropriate UV degrees of freedom back into that IR data. And so, you know, the descending superoperator really can be thought, what it does is it propagates out the conserved charges of the interior excitations to the UV boundary. And so, you know, the exterior of our tensor network really is enforcing the gravitational Gauss law. And so while we find that the perturbative quantum field theory associates the entropy to states, you know, we sort of just stick stuff in here and somehow this exterior really remains fixed because we don't worry so much about back reaction. That we've learned from kinematic space, that kinematic space is really sort of doing the non-perturbative task for us. The differential entropy is really counting a bunch of states that we get by filling in this interior, but sort of mapped into very different exterior space-times. That it is, you know, it is building the propagation out to the boundary. So it's clear that the tensor network propagates sort of Gauss law via the state out to the boundary, right? It takes the data of the IR state and builds a boundary state. But what about the geometry? So if the lower part of the tensor network remains unchanged, we sort of calculate the same asymptotic geometry for the state, right? And so we would have this sort of a bulk geometric version of Swingle's paradox. We would use the boundary asymptotic geometry from the tensor network and calculate the energy was still zero. And so it's important to note that we can create infrared states that violate our compression algorithm. So let's just take the sort of UV part of our tensor network, remove this upper part. We're left with sort of all these free indices. And now, you know, in the original vacuum state, say there was some correlation created between these indices. When I build my new state, I can do something more perverse. I can sort of correlate these two indices. But, you know, correlating these different indices would violate my compression algorithm. So now I have this tensor network. It prepares the state. But it's not the type of tensor network you're meant to build. So what we need to do is kind of rebuild our tensor network. We inserted something in the IR that has some ultraviolet effects. It's changing the entanglement entropies of these intervals. And so what I'd say is that the compression algorithm and how it rebuilds the tensor network is enforcing the gravitational back reaction. So, you know, compression is back reaction. And so it'd be really nice to find out, and something that I think is worth thinking about is, you know, is there some nice elegant rewriting of Einstein's equations in this language? Can we really show that our compression algorithm is the back reaction in the geometry? And then, oh, 2 minutes, good.
I thought I showed that yesterday.
Pardon?
I thought I showed that yesterday.
You would say that you can just interpret what you did as exactly this compression algorithm?
It's maximally entangled in a small region than the Einstein equation.
Yeah, so there might be, that might actually be very much the same thing. I need to think more about that. Yeah, that is an intriguing statement. Good. Okay, I'm learning something. You're learning something. This is wonderful. Okay. Pardon?
And you're almost.
I know. But I was going to say one thing because I think this is a surprising and interesting consequence of what we're doing, and it could, you know, if it's something that's wrong, it would maybe be detrimental to this whole endeavor. And if it's right, I think it's very surprising. So recall one of our aims was to better understand what holographic entropy is counting. So as a little toy model, let's consider two regions in our bulk. We have some region A. We have a very similar region B. It's like A, except we sort of added some very small, some long spike that goes into the interior. This long spike doesn't change, you know, the volume very much, but it adds some large contribution to the area of the boundary. So the Bianchi-Myers conjecture suggests that we should assign some entanglement entropy A to the factorization of the Hilbert space that corresponds to, you know, the interior of A and the exterior, and that this entropy, this entanglement entropy, is given by its area of its boundary. And they'd say the same thing should be done for B, and so that we really find that there is, you know, a much larger entanglement entropy, a larger entropy we associate to B than A. This makes perfect sense from the perturbative picture. If you're doing perturbative quantum field theory in a background, you know, that's wonderful because we know that the, you know, the leading contribution to the entangled entropy is just ultraviolet degrees of freedom that live near this boundary. And so it's kind of obvious if I increase the boundary, I add more ultraviolet entanglement. From the tensor network perspective, we might wonder, you know, do we see the same effect? Is the latter region encoded by a part of the network that prepares a much larger number of states? And the answer is no. The non-perturbative perspective given by the mirror and kinematic space sees this counting very differently. So this spike makes our surface non-convex. And such a surface is not encoded by a simple region of kinematic space. So here is the region of kinematic space that computes the area of that non-convex curve. And here is, you know, the area of kinematic space that computes the region of kinematic space that computes the area of its convex hull. So what you'll notice is that, you know, if I want to delete this portion of the tensor network and build states that are made by redoing this, I don't get any extra degrees of freedom by deleting something twice. Once I've removed it, I can't remove it again. And so the maximum number of states that I can get is really given by the convex hull. And so this extra contribution I get from integrating here again gives no more ambiguity in the state. There's no extra states I can put in here that have this extra double counting. So I can't assign a collection of states to the non-convex region in the same way that I could to the convex region, to the single-counted convex hull. So I'd say that the kinematic space approach suggests that a spike needs to be viewed, you know, the only way to really understand these extra bits here is I have no more ambiguity, I'm really constraining the state. So I can specify the state here, I can specify the state here, but now if I want to specify the state here as well, I'm constraining what I can do in here and not adding to my degrees of freedom. And so I want to say that only in special regions should we associate an entropy to a region of space-time that is proportional to the area, and that, you know, we're getting something that looks like a more refined space-time entanglement proposal, and it's really very markedly strongly different from the perturbative viewpoint. And so if what we're doing is correct, then this sort of Hawking pair picture, this sort of Rindler picture really breaks down at high energies and is incompatible with our counting. And at least for some regions, the entropy is much less than would be assumed for effective field theory. So, you know, this is, you know, I think profoundly different from what you do in perturbative QFT. And the question, one thing I think it's worth considering is, you know, what are the implications of this counting? This is very different. It's non-intuitive. So, you know, surely there is physics that depends on it. So I want to tell you about the RG. I don't have time. I'm just going to stop it here with this one question. So thank you very much.
Confused by the states you come from the potential network. Are these states of a well-defined quantum field theory? It appears to be not, because one of the constraints you might view impose on I3 being negative and satisfying the Hawking Page condition. These are true at large n, but having them being true at any finite n would be a strong violation of the well-defined quantum field theory state. So any consequence of this kind suggests to me that these are not nice states in any good field theory.
Yeah, so should be careful. So I mean this compression should be exact at large n. It should calculate the leading n contribution. I think, you know, subleading that you're going to allow violations of this. And you know, if I take just a typical CFT, I3 is not always negative, for example, and I can't build my type of tensor network. It just fails. So if you looked at some typical tensor network, some typical CFT, you need a Giffre's tensor networks to build it. And his tensor network, his mirror, will sometimes violate the assumptions that I'm making here. And so, you know, it is an assumption that at large n, that all of my rules are satisfiable, and they're demonstrably not.
Very large n in your
construct. So I have assumed that there is. Well, I gave you some axiom. I said do this type of compression, and I think it is certainly true that that type of compression is, I can prove to you that type of compression is not true for not possible for an arbitrary quantum field theory. So there are some arbitrary state, and so you need to use, so large n was sort of there at the beginning. I didn't tell you. I just said do this compression, and I never told you, you know, is that something that's always possible? And it's not.
Does your kind of tensor network realize Tadashi's surface state correspondence?
Yes, it does. Yeah, I think that they're very much related to each other. Because when we talk about, I mean, it's not, there's not a state that lives on any surface, but on any convex surface, what it defines is some cut in the tensor network, and that cut, you know, there's now an IR state, or there's an IR Hilbert space that lives on that cut that, you know, builds me some collection of states. So, yeah, I think they're very philosophically similar.
Specify that it's only for convex.
That's right. Yeah, and I think kinematic space gives you a good reason why, you know, it tells you why that had to be, why you couldn't have done something else.
What we need is some proper behavior. In any direction, we should have unitary evolution.
That's right, yeah.
So is that true?
Yeah, in gravitational states, that, you know, the requirement that you get this right two-interval entanglement entropy behavior requires that you have sort of maximally mixing or perfect tensor-like behavior. So I think that you can build more general states using these tensor networks. So given some assumptions, you know, we can build things that are not gravitational, and they will fail that criteria. But it's certainly true about gravity, I think.
So one more question: what about if you think of a time-dependent state? Mm-hmm. Do you add one more direction in your kinematical space?
Yeah, so I don't
have some correspondence between point and geodesy.
I don't have anything that I know is true to say about the time-dependent case. We have speculations, and so maybe I will not talk about them while recorded, because, you know, some significant fraction of them probably won't work out. But yeah.
And we can show them at quantum fusion, quantum gravity 3.
Yeah. You notice I didn't choose too many of the slides that showed why the questions that we were completely wrong on. So, but they're all online, so you can take my reenactment of history and go check the actual history. Yeah, so understanding local bulk operators is something that's very much a future direction that we haven't explored in great detail. And actually, maybe since I don't have time, rather than try to say anything about it, some ideas in this direction have already been explored by Lampros, and he has a nice poster downstairs in the lobby, which you can, if you don't want to read a poster, you should just go bother Lampros instead, and he will tell you all about it. But it's all there for you to look at, and I think it sort of is a first step in this direction.
So on that note, let's continue the discussion on coffee and thank you.